Hello and welcome to NPR News. I'm Tom Weber. We are now 5 days away from voters in St. Paul picking a new mayor to replace Chris Coleman. It's next Tuesday is the election, but you can vote now. And no matter where you're listening in Minnesota, you can find out what's on the ballot where you live at mnvotes.org. Today in our conversation with mayoral candidates in St. Paul, there's no clock, there's no buzzing for going over time, but in hopes of having a thorough conversation, we have asked candidates to respect each other's time and aim for no more than 2 minutes. But again, we will not have a formal clock. But I will say, just as a moderator, less can be more. I will jump in for follow-up questions or to get clarification as well. This is a two-hour debate. You can also be watching it on Facebook Live on our NPR News page. We have a live blog at nprnews.org. And because we're awesome, we have a hashtag, STPaulMayor. Is the hashtag. And again, if you're watching on Facebook Live, we're introducing the candidates now from left to right here in the room in alphabetical order. Melvin Carter is a former St. Paul City Council member. He worked in the governor's office on early childhood education matters. Thank you for being here, Melvin.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Dickinson is running as a Green Party candidate. The other candidates here today are DFLers. She has no elective office experience, but has been part of several community advocacy efforts in the city. Elizabeth, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Tom Goldstein is an entrepreneur. He's been a union organizer. He served one term on the St. Paul School Board. Tom, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
And Pat Harris is a former city council member, current member of the Metropolitan Airports Commission Board, and has served on boards for the Friends of the Library and the St. Paul Schools Foundation. Pat, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And Dai Tao, current city council member in St. Paul, who works for the Minneapolis Crisis Nursery. He has also worked with organizations including Take Action Minnesota and Isaiah. Dai Tao, thank you for being here. We will start off with, I'd love it to be brief, maybe a 30 seconds to a minute, with some introductory remarks for why you should be St. Paul's next mayor. And Melvin Carter, I'll start with you.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having us on here. This is a critical conversation. I'm Melvin Carter, and I'm running for mayor here in St. Paul because our city is at a critical turning point. The life outcomes for a child born in St. Paul today can be better predicted by that child's race and that child's zip code than by how smart she is and how hard she works. That's something that isn't fair to her, and it isn't sustainable for our entire city. We have to build a city that works for everyone, and that's going to require a mayor who knows our city well and who can walk in every neighborhood of our city. It's going to require a mayor who has a progressive track record and the experience to be able to walk in effective on day one, and it's going to require a mayor who has the strength and courage to meet big opportunities with a big vision for the future of this city. As someone who's grown up in this city, who knows what it feels like to get pulled over for driving while black, who knows what it feels like to live on a block that's been devastated by foreclosures, I have an experience in this city that allows me to walk and understand all of our neighborhoods well. As someone who served on the city council and who served both our mayor and our governor in executive branch government, I know the way executive branch government works. I know the Capitol well, and that's going to be something that's absolutely critical. And as someone who has spent the last few years immersed in every neighborhood and having conversations with folks about what the biggest and brightest future for St. Paul can be, we absolutely have built that big vision that'll serve St. Paul well. I'm excited to get to work.
Melvin Carter, thank you. Elizabeth Dickinson, hello.
Thank you. My name's Elizabeth Dickinson. I'm running for mayor of St. Paul. I've had a lot of cough medicine this morning, so I hope I sound okay. I am the Green candidate. I'm guided by the values of social, economic, and environmental justice. One of the policy pieces I think that makes me the most different from the guys who are running is probably an emphasis on energy and the environment. I've been endorsed by Sierra Club and by Clean Water Action. And other things that I really care about are making sure that we have an equitable city. I have also worked on things like being community affairs manager at the Minnesota AIDS Project. I have worked for Healthy Legacy on trying to get chemicals out of consumer products. And I have this wide range of policy experience, including education at the National Parent Teacher Association. And I think I can bring all of those things to bear on the mayor's office. And especially, I think what I'm good at is something the Star Trib has acknowledged, which is connecting people with resources available. I've been doing that all the way through, including connecting the police with the Brothers in Blue program to make sure that they can mentor kids. and things like that. So that's one of the things I'd like to do, is to be very available in the community.
Elizabeth Dickinson, thank you very much. Tom Goldstein.
Thank you. So I think the reason why I would be most effective as mayor is that I'm someone who is not part of the status quo. I agree that St. Paul is at a crossroads, and I'm reminded of a phrase that Paul Wellstone used to say, which is, we all do better when we all do better. And some people in St. Paul are doing better. If you own a baseball team, or you're a music promoter, or you want to build a soccer stadium or a new practice facility for your hockey team, or if you're a wealthy developer, you're doing better because there's been millions of dollars of subsidies available to you. But when it comes to the rest of the community, we pretty much have to figure out how to do it without that help. And, you know, I spent many years as a business owner where I've had to manage people. I'm the only person in this room that's actually managed people. When I was 25, I ran a bakery with 30 employees, many of whom were older than me, and I had to build relationships with them. I ran a store for many years where I had to hire and fire and actually be able to innovate. And I think in order to have a city that's going to work for everyone, we actually have to bring those qualities here, where we stress that education is important for everyone and that we have a citywide commitment to it. But that when we talk about a city that works for everyone, we can't have all these glitzy projects and all this money flowing into the hands of wealthy private individuals if we're going to do equity for everyone else and address the 25% poverty that we have citywide. So I am not an outsider. I served one term on the school board. I've been a frequent critic of how government works because I don't think it's working for all of us. And that's what I would change. I am not the tool of special interests. I am not bought and paid for, and I have the independence to actually work to build a city that's managed well and that serves everyone well.
Tom Goldstein. Thank you. Thank you very much. I didn't mean to cut you off there. Pat Harris, go right ahead.
Well, thank you so much. I'm Pat Harris, and I'm a fourth generation St. Paul resident. I've lived in St. Paul my entire life. My wife, Laura, my incredible wife, Laura, and I are raising our four kids over in the Highland neighborhood. You know, all my life, I've been about making a difference, and that's why I'm running for mayor. As a city council member, I was the city's leader on affordable housing for over a decade. I created St. Paul's Independent Public Library Agency. I was a leader on the budget in some of the most difficult budget times the city's ever had, when local government aid was getting cut by over $30 million. Been active on numerous nonprofits in our community. The Children's Museum, our incredible addition right down the street from where we're at right now. I started my career at Catholic Charities, where I work to help people that are experiencing homelessness to get jobs. I've been a public finance professional in the private sector for over 18 years, providing financial solutions for cities and schools and counties all over the country. I've made a career out of making a difference, and that's why I'm running for mayor, because St. Paul is at a crossroads, and I have a very specific plan on jobs, infusing $100 million into a very targeted jobs program in St. Paul. I have very specific plans on how to get more money in the St. Paul public school classroom. I have specific plans on public safety, on housing, on our libraries, and so many other things. Tom is right to bring up Senator Wellstone. You know, we all do better when we all do better, you know, and I really believe in that, and I believe that my specific proposals are going to make a difference in St. Paul, and that's why I'm running for mayor.
Thank you, Pat. And Dai Tao.
Good afternoon. I'm Councilmember Dai Tao, and I'm an IT professional by trade and community organizer by passion. I'm Asian American. I'm short. I'm a liberal. My family came here as political refugees. My father and his brothers fought on behalf of the United States. During our exile, I lost two sisters and a younger brother. I thought that America would be paradise, but when we got here, we were discriminated against. The poor and the working class were pitted against each other. It's not that there's anything wrong with poor or middle-class people. It's that there's something wrong with this system, and that system hasn't changed. I'm running for mayor to change that system. My bold and progressive leadership has resulted in a proven track record of changing the system, including police reform, cutting tax for seniors and low-income wage worker, workers' protection. I'm hardworking, and I won't quit at halftime. As mayor, I'll protect the people, promote equity, and preserve St. Paul's proud heritage. We, the people of St. Paul, we're hardworking, we're courageous, and we're determined. We just need our fair share of the investment and the opportunity to have a good life. You have a choice to make on November 7. You get to decide whether St. Paul continue this path of decline, high crimes, high taxes, and racial disparity, where regular people don't have a prayer, or you can join me in choosing a path of prosperity and progress for all. You see, I believe St. Paul could be that paradise. Let's draw the line against high crime, high taxes, and racial disparity. Let's unite across race and culture, genders and generation. Let's unite across incomes and neighborhood. Let's fight for each other's hopes and dreams. Let's create a united St. Paul where regular people have a seat at the table. I'm Councilmember Dai Tao, and I will appreciate your first choice vote on November 7th.
Thank you all. That's our introduction here as we have this candidates forum here for St. Paul Mayor with Melvin Carter, Elizabeth Dickinson, Tom Goldstein, Pat Harris, and Dai Tao. We are in the NPR studios here 5 days before the election. A lot of topics and issues I want to get to. I do have to start. Let's get it on the table, though, because in the past week, the campaign has seen a lot of news over a piece of campaign mail that was funded by a group that supports Mr. Harris and questions a burglary this summer at Mr. Carter's house. Two guns that Carter's father used as a police officer were stolen and have not been recovered. The piece of mail includes the line, over 100 shots have been fired since August 15 when Melvin Carter's guns went missing, which gives the impression that all 100 shots were fired by those two guns. A spokesman for the St. Paul Police told local media they do not believe that's the case, and I think there are probably some experts in probability who would question the premise as well. This has brought a cascade of reaction. So, Pat Harris, let me just start with you and talk about this off the top. This group work independently of you, but also in support of you. What should voters know about this incident?
Well, voters should know that I feel that the piece was appalling. I've rejected it outright. I've called for the resignation of the Police Federation Board. We've returned money. And it's not my character. It's not me. It's not the character of St. Paul. It's a preposterous theory in and of itself that correlation would be made. I consider Melvin to be a friend, and it's not what my character is all about. And, you know, it's Citizens United, something I obviously was not supportive of, that allows for independent expenditure groups. And we had no knowledge of it. We couldn't legally have any knowledge of it. And I just... really, truly, categorically rejected, and it has no place in this discussion. I think this is close to our 30th forum, and we've been talking about some good stuff and some stuff that's important, and then something like this comes up that clouds the logic of it all, and it's unfortunate, it's wrong, and I categorically and utterly reject it.
Do you, the organization that no longer exists was funded in part by the police and fire union. You note on your own mailers that you have those endorsements from those unions. Do you disavow those endorsements or still embrace them?
I've got many endorsements, trades, labor, St. Paul Fire, building trades, chamber, you know, Teamsters, Joint 32, 120. I've got many, many endorsements that I'm proud of. And I have called for the resignation of the leadership of the Federation, but I'm still proud to have the support of the women and men that are in our St. Paul Police Department, and I'm not going to let them down, and I'm proud to have their support. I think we need new leadership in that organization, but I'm proud to have the support of the women and men that are out there each and every day.
Melvin Carter, what should people know about this from your perspective?
That incident last week was troubling, and in many ways, it was even more violating than the original burglary at my home. My child, my daughter, came home from school, and, you know, children at school had been talking about this incident. My daughter came home from school and wanted to know if the police don't like us. I was able to tell her that that's not the takeaway to take from that experience, because this certainly is not the way St. Paul operates. And for every individual who was a part of that unfortunate incident, hundreds of people have come out of the woodworks to say they support our campaign, to make a contribution or to volunteer and help us talk to folks, including officers in our St. Paul department who have reached out to say, you know, that organization and specifically that mailer does not represent me. I think the most important thing to know about this isn't about a feud between me and the Police Federation. This comes in the shadow of me saying we need to change the underlying social contract between our police department and people all over our city. The only thing that's unique about what happened last year is it happened to a public figure in the public eye. Those types of interactions happen all over our city every day, and it's a reflection of the systemic racism that's built not just into how we police, but into institutional St. Paul across the board. That's what we have to change in our city. And that's actually why we just can't have a mayor who's beholden to the police union or those interests that have a stake, have a strong stake in keeping things the way they are.
The mailer did, Mr. Carter, question how quickly you called police after you learned of this crime. Is it valid to be questioning whether you alerted police in a timely manner?
It's just not valid. The first thing you should know is I, you know, came home, and as soon as I found out that someone was actually in my home, we called the police immediately. But far more importantly than that, my family was the victim of a crime. And, you know, we've worked really closely with the St. Paul Police Department, with the inspectors and the investigators there. They've, you know, done our family a great service, helping to seek justice and closure for our family. And so for police officers, through the guise of the Police Federation, to pretend that there's some other investigation that's valid, to re-traumatize our family in that way, is just unacceptable one way or the other.
Certainly, Elizabeth Dickinson, this news story has taken some of the oxygen out of the room in the last week, and I want to hear from the other candidates their thoughts on what has transpired here, but also, you know, going forward, you know, just reflections on that as well.
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously it was, in my opinion, it was a desperately unwise move on the part of the Police Federation and any of the people who contributed to it. And frankly, it's a distraction from an issue-based campaign, which this has been up until now. So I was very sorry for it. I was sorry for its effect both on Melvin Carter and on Pat Harris, and I'm really hoping that we can move on.
Tom Goldstein, any thoughts?
Well, you know, I want to be consistent with what I said yesterday when I was interviewed on AM 950. You know, I've been a victim of burglaries a couple times myself, and I know the feeling of, you know, that the sense of calm, that, you know, the concern that you hear noises at night and you wonder. So I know how that impacts someone. But I'm also someone that has spent many years working on gun violence issues back in 2000, 2001. Working to prevent concealed carry, and then later in the wake of Sandy Hook, lobbying at the Capitol for tighter gun laws. And so I am, you know, my feeling, what I said at the time was that I thought that this was a teachable moment for Melvin to just explain how his family had been violated, but that, you know, and he's sorry that these guns were not secured in his home, and that this is a lesson for all gun owners that you need to keep weapons secured so that they do not fall in the wrong hands. I think really that issue would have died then, and I think the media, the Police Federation's, what the Police Federation did is inexcusable to me, and there's no place in this contest or any time for that. I don't think it's a surprise, because I think if you know enough about that organization, I expected something like this would happen at the last minute. But I think the media missed an opportunity to just ask that simple question. You know, should the weapons have been secured? You can purchase a gun safe. And I, you know, with all due respect to Melvin, the guns were secured in his home. There was no danger to his children or anybody getting access to those guns. So I think he was very responsible in that way. But the guns are out in the community, and we know that all gun sales start as legal sales, and the only way they end up in the hands potentially of criminals if they're stolen or straw purchased or something like that. So I think it would have been helpful to just say, you know, I've suffered this loss and my family has been violated, but I also want to let all gun owners know you have a responsibility to make sure your weapons do not end up in the wrong hands. And I think the issue would be done. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't be talking about it 3 months later. And I'm not sure why the media didn't ask just that basic question, because I had that concern.
20 seconds, Melvin. Were the guns secured? I just want to get your take on what Tom said there.
Oh, yes, of course they were. My father is a retired St. Paul police officer, and I've learned really well how to secure firearms. The inaccuracies in what was just said have been well documented, so I can allow us to go on.
Daitao, finally, your thoughts here on this.
Yeah, when I saw the lid, I thought it was, you know, very disappointing, because it attacked Melvin, and then it also mischaracterized Pat Harris, who I've known, who doesn't represent those sort of value. But, you know, being attacked by the Federation is nothing new. as council member, they came after me for my work on reforming the police department and removing the two police officers off the civilian review board so that we can add additional nine civilian board members to include young people, mental health professional, and my work on the body cam and making sure that there's accountability and transparency there. You know, this is a critical situation in our community where I believe that Super PAC has no place in municipal race. Super PAC, we know that it doesn't work in our government, that they have huge influence on our federal and state government. And then municipal, at this level, we are supposed to be the first line of defense for regular people, hardworking people in our city. So I would challenge that, you know, we don't have Super PAC in the mayoral race. And, you know, a political attack has not been anything new to us. And this year, certainly, I've got my fair share of political attack against from lobbyists colluding with other people. When they investigated me, I cooperated 100%. And, you know, I'm proud that I'm the only candidate that has been clear and cooperated in any investigation. And I think that it's important that we have, if we want to serve in government, that we have that trust and that integrity from our community members.
Next issue I want to talk about here with our candidates for mayor of St. Paul. Yesterday, for a short while, Jackson Elementary in Frogtown was on lockdown because a man had been shot near the school. With 2 months left in the year, St. Paul has matched last year's total number of murders, 19. More than 130 people have been shot, which averages out to someone every other day. Sherry wrote in with this question. We did submit questions from people in the audience ahead of time. And it's just this: what will you do to decrease gun violence in St. Paul? I'm going to start with Elizabeth Dickinson this time.
You know, there are programs that were used in the 1990s in Boston that reduced gun violence by 62%, and I think in Stockton, California, by 42%. So it isn't a question of not knowing what to do. It's a question of making a commitment to what we can do. And I would start with community policing and putting the community back in community policing. I have a plan that I have put out there that is pretty detailed. It starts with education and making sure that the feeder schools that our police go through have the right amounts of de-escalation training, have the right amounts of cultural competency training, implicit, explicit bias training, all of those kinds of things. And to make sure that we have those ongoing for continuing ed. It means that the police are much more in the community, that the beat cops are, that they know the community leaders, they know the leaders of faith, and that they meet with them on a regular basis to target these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. You know, if we bring the community together with the police, that is how we reduce gun violence. There's a small number of people who continuously perpetrate gun violence. And if we focus on those people, if we say, we go as a group and say, we're not going to tolerate this. We're going to come down on you like a ton of bricks if you move out of line. That is what reduces gun violence. Besides that, we need to increase, go after the kids when they're liable to go into gangs, to provide the kind of intensive help to say, what do you need to do not to go down this path while their hearts are still open? And I know the police are doing some of that kind of training. You know, they've hired people out of the Wellstone Center to come in and kind of go door to door as part of community ambassadors. Those are the types of things, asking the kinds of questions. What do you need to do not to go down this path? What kinds of training do you need to stay off this path? Those are the things I think that we can do that will make a real difference.
A quick note, if you were trying to get onto us, get onto the Facebook live feed, it is working now again, so head over to the NPR News page on Facebook. Tom Goldstein, what do you do? This is the question again. What will you do to decrease gun violence in St. Paul?
Well, I think the roots of gun violence and the roots of the kind of gun violence that we've experienced this year in St. Paul, I think, reside in poverty, lack of opportunity, rec centers that have been closed. I think that our city bears some responsibility for choices that we've made about how to deploy our resources rather than putting, you know, bringing supports into our schools to get kids when they're young who may be in despair, who may be hungry, who may have reading issues, who may have mental health issues. We don't have that kind of continuum of care that I think is vital, not just to stop gun violence, but to make sure that kids have a path forward that's safe and has them part of society. And I think the choices we've made of how to deploy resources, when you close rec centers, when you raise rec centers, when you don't have after-school programming, kids have a tendency to get into trouble, particularly if they are homeless, if they are coming from a family that has been split up because someone may be incarcerated because of our failed war on drugs or any number of reasons. And, you know, they end up growing up. You know, there are kids that are in gangs that still go to school, that still play basketball, that are still part of the community. They're still reachable. But if there aren't opportunities for them to participate in the right track program, many other things, there's a chance they're going to fall into violence. I think from a policing level, the obvious thing we have to do is the way that any city needs to adapt to an emergency is to deploy resources in the areas that are hot. It means we shift officers around. It means that we get every officer behind a desk that we can on the streets. But long term, it means we need community policing. We need officers that live in the neighborhood, that know the community, that can reach kids. There are many police officers that volunteer and do work with kids that don't get a lot of credit for that, that actually try to be a positive influence in kids' lives. But we need to have people that live in our community, officers that live in our community, that are part of the community, so that we don't see the kind of incidents and we don't have kids that are, you know, or whomever, that are running wild and nothing's been done to respond. So the short term is deploy police resources, but get officers walking beats, going door to door, talking to people. And in the long term, it's about all the structural things that we have neglected. You know, I've said often that if we had spent as much time focused on education and poverty and mental health and affordable housing and job creation over the last 10 to 12 years, as we have building one stadium after another or one entertainment project after another with public money, we may not be facing these issues now, or we already may have solutions in place. So we have to change our priorities as a city, and those are some of the ways that I would go about it.
Pat Harris.
Well, I think Elizabeth and Tom make some great points, and Tom is definitely correct in that we, you know, jobs, education, affordable housing are all things that we need to take a look at in the long term, not just take a look at, take action on. And and I do have very specific plans on all of those that I'm sure we're going to talk about over the next 90 minutes or so. But Chief Axtell calls what's happening today is he calls it a public health crisis. And I agree with that. And so I have proposed a very specific 5-point plan on ending gun violence in St. Paul. And no point in this plan works without the other. So there's not one single thing. And you know, probably the first part of it is I do think, and I've been criticized for this, and I disagree. I mean, I believe that we need more police officers in St. Paul, and I'm committed to hire 50 new officers over a 4-year period. Everybody's talking that, you know, St. Paul's got 20,000 more people over the last 5-6 years, and we're expected to have another 25,000 over the next 5-6 years. If we want to have police officers get out of their cars, work within the community, if we want to have police officers to reflect the wonderful diversity of this community, if we want them to have relationships in schools, not patrolling schools, but having relationships in schools, we need to have more resources in order to do that. And I am proposing that. And it's a kind of a ridiculous theory to think there's going to be a phalanx of helmeted officers walking through neighborhoods. You know, this is about the police working with the community and developing relationships in the community. And so that is one piece of a 5-point plan that I have that includes empowering district councils. It includes a gun violence community prosecutor. It includes a gun violence coordinator in the mayor's office. It includes technology. It includes the mayor's office. And each piece of that plan must be in place in order for the plan to work.
How do you pay for the 50 new officers?
Well, you know, over a period of time, and I can tell you this as the budget leader for this, when I was on the city council for 12 years, the three mayors that I worked with were in councils were vehemently in support of always adding more resources we could to the police department. And there's numerous ways that we can look at financing these types of things. And, you know, if I said we're going to do it in one way, then I probably wouldn't be doing it in the smart way. So it's a combination, and I'm sure we'll talk about this when we talk about taxes, but
It's a combination of fund balances, debt restructuring, spending priorities, revenue generation, tax base, numerous things that come together so that you can prioritize something that the chief really does say, and I agree with him, that it is a public health crisis.
Daitao?
Gun violence has no place in St. Paul. And we have to draw the line here so that this issue doesn't get passed on to our kids and their kids. And to achieve that goal, as mayor, one of the things that I'm going to do is I'm going to beef up our undercover sting operation to root out the gangs and the gun trafficking folks that are coming into our town. I also want, as an IT person, I want to utilize technology to build on the work that I've done on the emergency alert system. This is a system that notify neighborhoods where there's an active shooter or an abduction on their landline, on their tax. I want to implement a shot spotter so that we can triangulate where the shots are coming from. This is a bold and progressive tech tool that we can use to send a strong message to the gangs and the folks who are shooting in our neighborhood to stay out of our neighborhood. At the same time, we want to make sure that our kids are being taught ways to resolve conflict, to restorative justice technique and tools, and don't rely on violence to resolve the conflict. I'm also interested in working to make sure that abuser who are in a domestic situation don't have access to gun, and their spouse can't get access to gun for them, and to make sure that we don't sell ammos or guns in the city of St. Paul limit. Also want to make sure that the work that I'm doing here is encompass a total, a overarching equity strategy so that our police officer are given the tools and the resource they need to do the work that they have to do in our community. That's why, as on a commission of the St. Paul Port Authority, I help fund the state-of-the-art training facility to help our police officer engage, de-escalate, and work within the community so they can provide trusted and respected service to all of our community. I'm anxious to do that work. I live in Frogtown. I'm in the middle of a lot of these gunshots, and I want to make sure everybody feel safe to live and to grow and to work in the city of St. Paul.
And Melvin Carter.
Across the board, one of the reasons so many of our challenges in St. Paul are so cyclical in nature is because we are constantly dealing with symptoms and not core issues. When I hear a public safety strategy that really revolves around flooding our city with more police officers and suppressing crime after it happens, I think that that's not a conversation about public safety. Public safety shouldn't be about hiring as many police officers as we can. It should be about building the types of neighborhoods that need fewer police officers. So we've bought into this false philosophy over the past generation that public safety is about hiring more cops and tougher prosecutors and building bigger jails. That's not only failed to produce safer neighborhoods, that's actually what is destabilizing our communities. That strategy has overcriminalized, particularly men of color. That strategy has disenfranchised people from our whole community. That's what's destabilizing our communities. That's what leads us to a place now in St. Paul where we spend twice as much money on police and fire as we do on recreation centers and libraries. And by the way, if we hire 50 new police officers in the next 4 years, that'll cost us $40 million over the next decade. That'll be why we can't afford to reinvest in our recreation centers and our libraries. My public safety plan says, let's start building neighborhoods that produce safer outcomes before something bad happens. That starts with investing in our schools, our recreation centers, and libraries that connect people of all ages to opportunity in our community. That means having police officers who know our city and who are invested in our neighborhoods and who reflect the diversity of our community. We already hire 40 to 50 officers a year just on turnover alone. We can do that with the existing size of our force. But the bridge that has to connect our strong, stable communities with accountable officers has to be trust. And we know that that trust has been broken. And when that trust has been broken in the way that it has been, that impacts our ability for our communities and our officers to work together as a team to produce safe outcomes. I'll invest in that trust first by revising use of force. We have to reform our use of force policies in the city so that we can all be on one accord as to when our officers are and are not authorized to use force, and so that we can maintain our ability to hold officers accountable when their actions fall below our expectations. My plan says calls for building mental health response teams so that when our officers encounter people who are in a mental health or substance abuse crisis, they have the tools that they need to connect that person to help. That also will help us reduce use of force incidents in St. Paul. And my plan calls for our civilian for empowering and raising the visibility of our civilian review panel, because we know that trust has been broken in the light cannot be fixed in the darkness. Everything that we do about public safety relies on our communities and our police officers being able to work together as a team. That's where the core challenge is, and that's what we have to fix.
I'm going to start the next question So
I just wanted to, just not to respond to Melvin, but more to Pat and just in general about policing. I was trying to respect the time and didn't realize that people were going to go into their individual platforms, because we all have one about policing. But, you know, one of the things that we're not talking about that is somewhat beyond our control is getting guns off the streets is also a key to reducing violence. And at the state and federal government, we have seen complete inaction to try to do simple things like universal background checks at gun shows so that it is not so easy to acquire weapons. We need our state and federal leaders to take action as mayor, because I have done work in the past on trying to reduce weapons and make sure that we have responsible gun owners, is to work on pushing so that we are not confronting the influx of weapons coming from other communities onto our city streets. So, I mean, at the core, we also need to get the weapons off. And I agree with many of the things that Melvin said. I also know that we have not had the police chief bring forward a plan saying that he needs this many officers, this is how he would deploy them, these are the outcomes that are expected. I think it's, behooves a mayor to be responsible that you wait until that's brought forward. When we hired 20 officers to get up to about 620, we were told we were going to be at full strength as a police department. So to me, we need to have accountability measures that in the department, that's not simply just to protect and serve, but it's about what are the outcomes we're expecting, how are we going to deploy officers so that we can actually measure results beyond response times or those kinds of things, because it's all related and there are not unlimited resources, and money that goes into policing is not money that might go into civilian positions, which would free up such as social workers or others to investigate accidents and other things like that that don't require an officer to be there.
Okay.
We might be able to free up resources that way for our existing officers.
I want to be able to get to some other topics too, so just keep that in mind. Again, we're not going to buzz you, but we can get to more topics depending on how long people take to answer questions, which is fine. So Ramsey County reports on another topic here, a 22% increase in what's called unsheltered homelessness this year. A very well done story in the Pi Press recently noted a doubling of long-term hotel use by families. It's worth noting that a majority of people who are homeless in Minnesota are children and are in families, and they live in places we don't see, like hotels. It's also worth debunking a myth: most homeless people work and have jobs. What specific ideas are you proposing to address this increase in homelessness, especially the homelessness we don't see day to day? And Tom Goldstein, I will start with you.
Well, about 10 years ago, I worked on affordable housing and on homelessness issues for the Minnesota Housing Partnership, and it was my responsibility to help organize forums at the Capitol, where we actually turned out to lobby elected officials. And, I'm sorry to say that it seems like we're still contending with the same issues. Wilder puts out studies periodically that show the homelessness issue is not being addressed. And so the fundamental question is, why have we not solved the homelessness issue in St. Paul? Why aren't we putting the same kind of energy into making sure that everyone has safe and secure housing as we're putting into subsidizing one development after another in downtown?
So the proposal, your proposal centers around affordable housing.
I would say more it's about the priorities that we have as a city. What are the issues front and center? And I think with 25% poverty, an issue that has not been talked about at the city really in any significant way and wasn't really being talked about on this campaign other than myself until recently, we have not been talking about poverty. We have not been open. I mean, there's a tendency in St. Paul, it seems, to always want to tell a positive story, perhaps because we live in the shadow of Minneapolis. But we have real issues here. How are we going to solve them? So to build a unit of affordable housing is around $150,000 in general. I think one thing we should look at as a city, in addition to making sure that whatever housing project that we build has a greater percentage of affordable housing, is also look at a way, if we can free up funds, to provide housing subsidies. So that people who may not, you know, Section 8 has been one of the most successful federal programs, but it comes with a stigma, and a lot of landlords won't take it. We may have people that don't qualify for Section 8 but are still among the working poor that may be dealing with homelessness, where it might be a subsidy of $100 or $200 a month that is what they need to get in to housing. And so
a city-run, a city-administrator subsidy program is what you're talking about.
Well, I mean, it could take many forms. I mean, it's just the idea that we look at how we deploy resources to address housing. I certainly favor that we build more, you know, we have more density and more affordable housing. But, for example, where we're building a soccer stadium in the Midway with transit connected there would have been an ideal way to build affordable housing, which I don't think is going to happen now because we have a stadium dominating that site. I think the Ford plant is also a place to look at affordable housing. But if it's done in such a way that there are not jobs there as well, and there's not transit as well, we end up housing someone where they have to go somewhere to find a job, if they can find a job. And I think one of the issues we don't, that's also invisible to us, is people who have to spend a couple hours on a bus getting to a job. So dealing with affordable housing is dealing with transit, it's dealing with job creation. That means having a really forward-thinking plan about how we're going to use technology to bring more firms here and grow our tax base so that we have the ability to help administer those programs. And I also question, you know, we have this wonderful facility being built downtown by Catholic Charities that's great, except that it's sucked up a huge amount of foundation money, and we still have homeless people that are downtown with nothing to do. I would look to make those people ambassadors for the city, to use them as a way, you know, to give them dignity and pride and employ them in helping out in the city, maybe giving tours of the city. I mean, I know it might sound completely out of left field, but I think a lot of people need jobs that give them dignity, and the city could provide a small stipend so that people could do that. But I also, people could be part of the city and take some pride in that. But I also think we need to have shelters dispersed throughout the community and not just concentrated in downtown, because there aren't jobs downtown for people that are dealing with homelessness and where we're attempting to house them.
Pat Harris, specific ideas to address homelessness in St. Paul?
It's a great question, and there are the large issues like wages and other things and education related to poverty, but and we're going to talk about those. But, you know, I've spent the better part of my life dedicated to working on the issue of homelessness. I was employed by Catholic Charities. I served on their board for 12 years in the city council. I was the singular leader on issues related to homelessness, and we need to do better. We can't wait for developers to come to the mayor or city council and say, I'm proposing this. You know, I went out to the development community. I went out to Project for Pride and Living. I went out to Catholic Charities. I went out to the private development community. I said, I want to get some projects done. I did that when I was on the Family Housing Fund board. And I am completely and utterly dedicated to making an impact on the issue of affordable housing at some of the deepest levels of poverty. You know, I was part of the city's affordable housing policy, which stated that 20% of all city subsidized housing developments should be have units that are 20% of the units should be at income levels of 30% of median income or lower. And I would actually change that as mayor to have some levels in the 5 and below percentage and 5 to 10% of median income, so that we can continue to work on making sure that we have available affordable housing at the very, very lowest income levels, down to zero income. And so it's something that I've really truly dedicated my life to, and whether it's single room occupancy housing, SRO style housing, or shelter beds, or other things, you know, whether it's the higher ground, you know, that model that Catholic Charities is doing, I think that's an incredible development and incredible leadership by Tim Marks and the board of Catholic Charities to move that project forward. And Mayor Coleman, the city, was instrumental in that in the state as well. And so I'm just going to continue the leadership that I've been doing and being in the mayor's office. I think we're going to be able to do even more on this issue. It is a critical issue. It's one that I will make an immediate impact on.
Daitao.
Thank you. You know, homelessness is not a problem that's going to go away. And so we have to address it right now and try everything we can to protect the people and lift those who are among us that have the least. And that's why I choose to work at the crisis nursery. That's my part-time IT job. And I every day we deal with family, displaced family who's been abused, neglected, has lost their home. My mom, you know, she lost her home to eminent domain in North Minneapolis in the public housing. And so I know what it's like to be displaced and to not have a home. And so as a council member, I have a proven record of fighting for affordable housing. You've seen my work in leveraging that at the Foresight to make sure that if you have $18,000, you make $18,000 a month, you can live in Highland area. I'm also working on anti-housing discrimination ordinance that protect returning citizen, protect voucher Section 8 voucher recipient, protect rentee from discrimination and renting in the city of St. Paul. I'm also working on the poverty task force on this city council to make sure we get to the root cause, whether it's economic or it's discrimination. And that is why I support $15 minimum wage. We need to, as mayor, I want to continue our work with our partners, Ramsey County, our emergency shelter, to make sure that we have wraparound service. That's why I'm proud of my work on the St. Paul Promise neighborhood when it was falling apart. I came into office and helped the leadership to lift that up so that we could get more funding and resources from our community partners and leadership to work with family in Frogtown to ensure that they have a places to live and school to quality education. I'm also looking at proposing tiny houses and district in the city of St. Paul. I think that that has worked in other city, and I want to champion that. I'm also working on home loan so that we can provide low-interest loan to property owners. They can fix up their space, but the deal and the condition is that they can't raise the rate, the rent, and force their rentee out of their home. And so some of these work, the work that other candidates are talking about, I'm already doing that work, but as mayor, I'll have more leverage to solve this problem for all of us.
Melvin Carter.
Stable housing is a basic human necessity that impacts everything. Homelessness in our community impacts education outcomes, impacts public safety, impacts employment, and everything else. Our growing population, our low vacancies, and already rising rents create a perfect cocktail that really a dangerous mix that could signal a housing crisis on the horizon. Supporting affordable housing projects in someone else's neighborhood isn't leadership. We need a holistic citywide plan to ensure that we're providing dignified housing for people of all ages and also income levels in our city. As mayor, I'll fight for more units. We need more units in our city, and that means looking for opportunities for smart density and places where we can build up and identifying opportunities to incentivize developers to just bring more affordable units online at all income levels. We do have that city plan that we want 20% of our new units to be affordable. The way we've met that plan has been to say we're going to have, you know, four market rate units over here, buildings over here, and a subsidized building over there. That misses the goal of building the type of city where every child can look around them and see a doctor or a lawyer or an electrician or a teacher that they can aspire to be like. I think we ought to enforce that goal, that policy, whenever city involvement is involved in a project that's funding or special permission. I worked with Council President Russ Stark when I was on the city council to create the city's Affordable Housing Trust Fund. And I think that can be a strong tool to help not just build new units for new residents, but to make life more affordable for people who already live in that city, as live in our city as well. So it's a combination of new units and supporting existing residents to make sure that community life is affordable for everyone.
And Elizabeth Dickinson.
Well, I believe any new development that happens needs to include 20% affordable. I believe it as part of that 20% that it definitely needs to include a percentage that is for 30% of average mean income, because those are some of the most vulnerable people in our population, people who are suffering from mental or physical disabilities. And I also believe that it needs to be indexed at a local level, not at a state level, because often the incomes at a local level are less than at a state level. I believe that we need to keep affordable housing affordable so that when there is affordable housing and an owner decides to sell, I believe there should be a first look provision so that people who want to buy it, who would keep it affordable, like nonprofits, should get first dibs on it. I believe in density bonuses for any developer who's going to put in affordable housing. And I believe that we could fast track and streamline permitting for anybody who's doing affordable housing. I believe in the tiny homes. I believe we should also look at manufactured and modular homes and potentially put those in places like some of the parks. That could be an innovative way to deal with it. And finally, I would say that there are an awful lot of kids who are homeless. I know that when we were at the High School for Recording Arts, the principal said that over 50% of the students there were homeless on any given night. And that's just unacceptable. And I would propose working with seniors. I've talked with Council on Aging to come up with a pilot program that would pair seniors who would like to stay in their homes that have an extra bedroom, to pair that with a pilot program with homeless youth. You know, obviously there would need to be screening on both sides, but I think that could be an innovative way to solve two problems at one time.
We're coming to the end of the hour, so I thank you all for your questions. We have another hour coming up. If you're in Greater Minnesota, you will not hear the second hour on the radio, but you can listen online at nprnews.org. Very quickly, last few minutes, one or two word answers, if you don't mind, just because we have a time crunch. You're all asking everyone who's voting to vote for you for your first choice, but we have ranked choice in St. Paul. Who are you telling your supporters to support as their second and third choices? Pat Harris.
You know, I really haven't decided.
And, okay.
We'll see as we go forward.
Dai Tao.
I'm not telling my voter to vote for, you know, I think it's up to them. That's what I love about ranked choice. But I am asking for all of them to rank me as their first choice. And I've committed to Elizabeth that I would. I'd like to see a woman mayor in the city of St. Paul, and so she has my second choice.
She'll be your second choice.
Absolutely.
Melvin Carter, who are you telling people to vote?
We're encouraging people to use the opportunity that ranked choice gives them to rank their ballot. We are certainly asking folks to rank me first, and we're finding a whole lot of folks that when we find someone who's supporting someone else, we're asking them to rank me second. Other than that, we're not making any specific picks.
Okay. Elizabeth?
Yeah, I think I'm obviously asking for people to make me their first choice. And I honestly believe that if people make me their first choice, that it's up to them in their conscience about who they choose as their second choice.
And Tom Goldstein.
I think the context has come in, and I've just focused on ranked choice voting and the fact that there is no wasted vote. You can vote for the person that's the best choice. Obviously, I'm running. I think I'm the best choice. But it really hasn't come up where people have asked me, who's your second or third choice? Mm-hmm. So I think Elizabeth and I are most closely aligned politically. So I will leave it at that.
And you'll leave it at that. Again, you're listening to a debate among five candidates for St. Paul Mayor: Melvin Carter, Elizabeth Dickinson, Tom Goldstein, Pat Harris, and Dai Tao. We're at the end of the first hour. We're going to take a break for news. And again, the second hour on the radio, you'll only hear in the metro. If you're in Greater Minnesota, you can stream at nprnews.org. And also check us out on Facebook Live on the NPR News page on Facebook. And all of this will be posted on the podcast for this show later. Search wherever you get your podcasts for NPR News with Tom Weber. Please vote. Election Day is next Tuesday, and you can vote now. There's information on where to do that and what's on the ballot wherever you live in Minnesota at mnvotes.org. Hello and welcome to NPR News. I'm Tom Weber. This hour, our second hour of a forum featuring five candidates running to be the next mayor of St. Paul. If you're watching us on Facebook Live, your candidates, as I'm reintroducing them, are from left to right. You can also, again, you can watch us on Facebook Live on the NPR News Facebook page. We have a live blog at nprnews.org as well. Melvin Carter is a former city council member and former official in Governor Dayton's office. Longtime community activist Elizabeth Dickinson is running as a Green Party candidate. The other candidates here are DFLers. Tom Goldstein is a former member of the St. Paul School Board. Pat Harris is a former member of the St. Paul City Council. And Dai Tao, sitting directly to my right here, a current member of the City Council. The next question, and this hour we're only on the radio here in the metro, so I want to jump into some more specific topics, St. Paul-centric topics, if you will. And this is a question we got on voicemail. So let's just give a listen to that right now.
Hi, my name is Ryan Ricard, and I live in the McAllister-Groveland neighborhood in St. Paul. And my question for the St. Paul mayoral candidates is this. I'm excited to see that the Riverview Corridor now has a locally preferred alternative of modern streetcars connecting downtown St. Paul to the airport along West 7th and Highway 5. What will you do as mayor to help make the vision of better transit down West 7th Street a reality, even in the face of business opposition? Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Ryan, for that question. Pat Harris, in general, do you support the streetcar idea for 7th Street?
Well, I definitely support moving forward with discussing the streetcar. I mean, there are some challenges with this on the airport end of it and on the Ford plant end of it in terms of how we're going to be able to achieve a quick result from downtown St. Paul to the airport. So there's still some engineering challenges and some cost challenges. I definitely support the rejection of the light rail proposal, and the BRT proposal has some interest level for me as well. I think one of the issues here, you know, Minnesota needs, but we need better transit in St. Paul. I mean, if we want to move communities forward, it has to improve. I mean, this is a critical issue. But if you're going to do transit, you have to do it right. The modern streetcar is a really interesting way of doing it. I sort of don't like the name modern streetcar. It's kind of like an ultra light rail. I mean, it's a very efficient process. It doesn't take a traffic lane. It takes a parking lane. My concern is the construction process, you know, could really, truly, seriously damage businesses along the West 7th corridor. And I think that needs to be considered as we're going forward in this process. But I definitely support taking a good, hard look at the modern streetcar. I think it can make a huge difference for businesses. I think it can make a huge difference for residences. It has to get to the airport. As an airport commissioner, I can tell you the complexities of how to get rail transit to the backside of the airport is extremely cost prohibitive and time prohibitive as well. So it's imperative that if we're going to do a rail line in St. Paul of that magnitude, it has to provide the service level that we need in terms of the time from downtown to the airport. We have to mitigate the impact to business on the construction period. We have to mitigate the parking impact too, mm-hmm. for the loss of parking lane. But I definitely prefer the modern streetcar, the ultralight rail, as I'm like trying to coin it.
Yeah.
The ultralight rail over the hard light rail for sure.
Daitao, do you support the streetcar for West 7th?
You know, thanks, Tom. Thanks for the question, and thanks for the caller for the question. I support mass transit, and I support equitable transit. And whether it be streetcar, rapid bus transit, or light rail, some of the work that I've been doing at St. Paul City Council, including the bike plan, we have to make this city work for all of us. It can't just work for some of us in order for us to thrive and have a sustainable city. And so from my experience coming at the tail end of the light rail on the Green Line, I saw that many businesses were displaced. Many businesses felt like they weren't heard. The people on the council before my time didn't pay attention to them, didn't help them mitigate. And so as mayor, if we want to put a streetcar or light rail or rapid bus transit on 7th Street, we have to make sure, as Pat Harris said here, that we have to mitigate and make sure that it's a system that works for all of us, not just some of us. And we're thinking and we're planning for the future. The future is we need to have equitable transit. The longer we wait, the more expensive construction projects become. And so I'm prepared and I'm ready to work with everybody from the city, especially our partners, Ramsey County. They have a stake in this. The state has a stake in this. And our federal government have a stake in this. And so I'm ready to bring those partners together and make sure that this transit system works for all of us.
But it sounds like you're not completely sold yet on the streetcar for West 7th. Do I have that right?
Well, I need to. I support streetcar. I support rapid bus transit. I support mass transit. I haven't personally seen the proposal that is going to be put forth. So, but what I want to do is I want to make it work for our business along West 7th Street, too, because I've seen how detrimental it's been for the businesses along University.
Melvin Carter, streetcars along West 7th.
Yes, streetcars along West 7th. I'm excited to advocate for streetcars along West 7th. Access to transit, or lack thereof, is how we institutionally as a community either connect or cut off whole communities from the greater prosperity of our city. I'm excited to build a modern streetcar on West 7th. Streetcar and rail has the advantage of stimulating more economic development in a way that buses don't. Streetcars, you can add capacity in ways that are more difficult to do with even a rapid bus rapid transit line. This is where my experience on the Green Line will come into handy, will come into play for St. Paul. I first ran for city council because we were planning a $1 billion light rail line along University Avenue that wasn't even going to stop and pick people up in our most transit dependent neighborhoods. When we think about that, would be ridiculous to do that. We spent a lot of time working with the Met Council, working with the governor, working with the FTA in Washington, D.C., and that experience will come, will serve St. Paul well from day one when I'm on the city council. As we've seen the Green Line fundamentally transform University Avenue with millions of dollars of investment there as a result of that, we can see that right on West 7th as well. And long term, the goal is to connect St. Paul through transit, not just to the airport, not just to Minneapolis, but to Woodbury and Forest Lake, and even high speed rail to Chicago coming into Union Depot. That is a critical vision that can make St. Paul not just the middle of the economic region, but really position us as the center of the economic region. And I'm excited to lead forward on that as mayor.
And finally make Minneapolis the suburb of St. Paul.
I'm sorry, where?
That's the joke I made on Monday, too. Elizabeth Dickinson, streetcar on West 7th, yes or no?
Yes, I think some of the advantages of that are that cars can go over the rails, which they can't with light rail. And so I think that that will open up the traffic patterns in a way that light rail doesn't. I also think we need to be sensitive to the business concerns along there, particularly during construction, but also afterwards in terms of making sure that there is adequate parking. If they're losing parking, you know, I think that we need to be able to do bump outs and places that show we still value the businesses along there. But in general, yes, I think anything that trains and streetcars are definitely more popular than buses. I think you're going to get more people using them. And anything we can do that gets people out of cars helps mitigate climate change. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to close up that triangle. You know, we've obviously got light rail from the airport to Minneapolis, Minneapolis to St. Paul. Let's close up that triangle so people can get all the way around the city.
Tom Goldstein, streetcars on West 7th.
I went to a recent meeting where this proposal was announced and was not familiar with the alignment. So seeing the idea that it actually runs in the parking lane, I mean, it's intriguing. The question is this the best way to move people, the most efficient, and why is there so much opposition among the businesses on West 7th? You know, there's what I've observed in St. Paul during the last decade is there's this tendency to view people that disagree as just people that are out of touch, that don't want to change anything, that their opinions are not valued. I think the first thing we need to do, and this goes to the city in general about how we do public processes, is rather than just recognizing the opposition, and if you know the right people or if certain groups have influence, we're going to pass this over the objections of other people, is to actually get buy-in. Let's find out what the business's objections are. If it's strictly about parking, will this mitigate parking? I think we have not had a full accounting of what happened on University Avenue with light rail. There was close to 100 businesses that were lost because the city dropped the ball and just sort of pointed fingers at Metro Transit when it's the city's responsibility to take care of the businesses and residents that were impacted. I mean, yes, you know, we got three additional stops, in part as a result of Mr. Carter's work, although I think the organizations that got behind that were really the driving force. But what about the jobs? What about the housing that comes with that? The people who have access to light rail, how do they get to light rail? Traditionally, when light rail is built, busing is cut. So if you can get to University Avenue, you can get to downtown Minneapolis or St. Paul, but the getting to University Avenue is a challenge for a lot of people because we don't have a larger plan about buses on north-south streets. So having access to the airport is certainly important. Whether the alignment should go the way that it's talked about or should actually use the spur of the Ford plant, the abandoned Ford plant and go that way is up to question. I mean, I think there needs to be buy-in, and it's not just the businesses. Many neighbors on West 7th are in opposition as well. So as a community, before we move forward with any plan, because it's about $480 million for bus rapid transit and over a billion for the streetcar, We have to be honest about how are we going to pay for it. The money just doesn't come out of thin air. But also, we need to get buy-in so it's a win-win. So the city has work to do persuading people rather than just saying, this is what we're going to do, and you need to adopt to it.
Opponents of the Ford site plan, which was recently approved, are now working to gather signatures to put the question to voters. They actually want to reverse what the city council recently approved. Aside from that, do you support what the city council recently approved? And Daitao, I'm going to start with you because you voted no. So I know the answer to that is no. But would you want to revisit this? Would you want to re-vote if you are elected mayor?
I'm in support of overall development in the Ford site, but I was disappointed that we couldn't come together to find a compromise. There's so much history, so much that has been done in that neighborhood, especially the ballpark where kids have grown up in that area, and now they're adults and they're raising their family in the area. And I think I always thought that America would be a place where everybody's voice can be heard, and that if you and you're valuable, and that if you invest in a neighborhood, you're the one that has helped bring that neighborhood up to the way that it is. That we just can't bend over and then roll over and let big corporate, big profit company comes in there and divide us. Because the plan that it is right now, without a compromise, it's maximized for profit, and it is tearing the community apart. It's pitting neighbors against each other. I don't want to build a St. Paul like that. I think that we can do better as St. Paul. And so I haven't heard that they are doing that, but I think there's still opportunity for us to bring people to the table. That's why I wanted to make sure that there's a community benefit agreement so that it leaves every player, every neighbor, everybody that's interested at the table, working with the developer to make this plan work for all of us. I'm excited about what can be done there, but I'm also concerned that not everybody's heard. In the city of St. Paul, the status quo, the business as usual, is having many form. But I think that we should measure our policy based on outcome. And voters know when they're being heard, because our policy reflects what they've said to us. We can't just go through this on autopilot and then disrupt the lives of many people. And there's going to be traffic jam there, because I work on the soccer stadium. I work at the Vintage. And there is traffic congestion there, and there's health issue. Right now we have a Starbucks over at Marshall and Snelling that it's a traffic log jam there, and the winter is coming. And so we have to make sure, like they say in carpentry, measure twice and cut once. And I think that there's still opportunity for us to bring everybody to the table to ensure that the plan works for all of us.
I wasn't sure if the Starbucks on Marshall would get a mention, but it did here today. Melvin Carter, as you know, also just another note here, one of the issues that the opponents had was some of the parcels and the density around there and the traffic concerns. Do you support what the city council recently approved?
Yes, I support the site plan for the Ford site. It's a critical opportunity for our city. St. Paul is growing fast. We've added 20,000 people in the last 7 years alone, and we're projected to keep on growing over the next 20 years. We all would agree that we're at an urgent point where we have to add more housing. We have to add more jobs. We have to expand our tax base to sustain our growing population. We all also agree that the Ford plant is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to do all of those things. So it's beyond me how we can just logically come to the conclusion that we should limit the amount of housing that we build at the Ford plant, which is a huge opportunity for us, that we should limit that. I'm looking forward to making the most of that opportunity and ensuring that we use that in the best way that we possibly can to really start this process of building St. Paul for the future. At the core, though, this is a conversation bigger than the zoning, the underlying zoning of this one parcel. The question is, when we think about building St. Paul for the future, when we come upon big opportunities, we have to have a mayor who's willing and who has the courage to meet big opportunities with a big vision for the future of St. Paul. That's why I support the site plan, and I'll be excited to continue to move it forward as mayor. We talk about process, and I like to remind folks the process around the Ford plant is actually older than my fourth grader. There's a lot of process that'll continue as we turn that into actual kind of development projects and work with developers to see that come to fruition. But we have to be able to have those deep conversations. They all have to be geared towards toward action. And when we build a good plan, as we have to be ready to execute it and take action as mayor.
Elizabeth Dickinson, do you support what the Ford plan was approved as?
In general, yes, I do. I truly believe that this will be a kind of beacon of sustainability if we do it right. I've loved the idea of tiered housing so that everyone gets a view of the river. I've loved the idea of using stormwater runoff to create an aesthetically pleasing water feature through it. And I think there are still a lot of questions to be answered about how it actually gets developed. And in terms of the folks who are lobbying to get a ballot referendum to revisit it, you know, that's part of participatory democracy. And so, you know, I salute the fact that they have that much conviction in terms of what they believe that they want to go through and do this. And so I support them doing that. I mean, whatever happens, whether that goes forward and it fails or it goes forward and it succeeds and we have to look at it, I believe there are still a lot of opportunities for public feedback because Ford can sell it to whomever they want. And it's at the point that the developer comes in that I think the rubber meets the road. And so I'm not as, how can I put it? I'm not as concerned that there will not be additional opportunities for public input, because as mayor, I would make sure whatever happens, that the public is involved at every step of the way.
Tom Goldstein, do you support what they did, what they approved?
Well, the way I'll answer this is that I think whoever is mayor, this plan is going to get revisited many times. Mm-hmm. And my opposition, I don't support the timing. I was the first candidate who was very clear about my opposition to the process. The timing of this announcement, I believe, is tied to the political ambitions of our mayor who's running for governor. Ford does not have a developer in place. They have not even finished the cleanup. If you go back a few years, you will note that Ford has periodically talked about how they were going to have the site for sale in 2016, 2017, 2018. We don't really know what the pollution situation is. Ford is not going to volunteer and say, hey, we have more pollution that we encountered. So there's a lot of stuff. It's unfortunate that so much energy went into something, and I think it's because a proposal was being pushed through for reasons of political expediency actually than need. Changing the zoning, to me, was also premature, because typically developers come in with proposals, and if the existing zoning doesn't meet that proposal, if the city or the neighbors are excited by it, the city can change the zoning appropriately. I've heard people say, oh, well, you know, you need to signal the developers and make it clear, you know, what's going to happen there. Otherwise, they're not going to invest. I think if you actually look at what's happened in this city and many other cities, zoning is never really an impediment to someone who has a creative project. And that's usually the way it should work. So to me, that's what's been premature. You can have meetings for 10 or 12 years, but it doesn't mean that people are necessarily being listened to. I have seen St. Paul evolve into a place where we always break people up into community small groups, and we don't get people able to talk to one another so that you know what ideas were said in this group, in this group, in this group, and who said them. And so there's too much of a reliance on this, you know, the current trend in public meetings where we break people up, and it seems like a way that you bring forward an idea without full buy-in. I think the city, when they saw the level of rancor that existed in January, we should have employed mediators to get at the source of that, the same way with that I talked before about West 7th, because I think people will support good ideas. And I think the bigger concern to me in general about many of our projects is we had 2,000 jobs at that site. Those jobs went away. I would have originally tried to keep the Ford plan intact to see if we could promote, you know, the same kind of, you know, you could have repurposed that plant for a number of potential, you know, perhaps an Amazon distribution facility, not the 50,000 person headquarters, yeah, but headquarters. There would have been a lot of uses. So how are we going to create jobs if we're not focused on that? So there's a lot that needs to be revisited. So that's a site that really is this golden opportunity that we can take advantage of.
And Pat Harris, do you support what they did?
I actually did not support it, and I appreciate Councilmember Tao's vote on that issue. You know, I created, as the council member who represented that area for 12 years, I created the Ford Site Task Force.
I created the Ford Open Space Task Force, and I believe in really taking a hard look at the impact around the surrounding neighborhood, taking a look at the impact to the environment, the River Bluff. Now, I do support more green space on that site. I do support the ball fields, obviously. It's an important 63-year-old amenity into this entire city. I think the financial projections that the city's put out are flawed because they don't look at the destabilization of property values around it. I just believe that the site is a legacy site and needs to be treated as such. But at the core of it, though, I believe the city made a strategic mistake in that you don't pre-zone a site that's a 148-acre nationally recognized site. It's highly unusual. And what I fear is an out-of-town developer is going to come in with a pre-zoned site. They're going to build to the maximum density that they possibly can. They'll spin off to the to a private equity group, and they'll get a new house in the Hamptons, and we're left with a cheap project that has too much density and that has too many cars in the neighborhood and that doesn't have enough green space. So the zoning is the aces in our hand, and I feel like when you give away the zoning, all you have left is some nines. And we need the aces in order to move forward on this project. That being said, I do believe we need housing on that site. I do believe we need jobs on that site. We definitely need jobs on that site. We need additional green space on that site, but we have to be cognizant of the impact to the surrounding neighborhood. That's what any council member does when they're looking at developments across the city, is like, how does this impact the neighborhood? Whether it's your neighborhood or somebody else's neighborhood, you need to look at that impact. Look at the smart view of the financial projections and make sure we get a high-quality development that is a legacy development, because this thing's going to be there for 200 years. And it has to be a development that reflects the character of this community. Giving away the zoning was a strategic mistake. I'm hoping we can recover from that process and get what truly will be a legacy development for St. Paul.
Pat Harris, Dai Tao, Melvin Carter, Elizabeth Dickinson, and Tom Goldstein are with me this hour as we talk to these five candidates for mayor. The election is next Tuesday. You can vote now, though. There's early voting set up in Ramsey County. MNVotes.org is one place to find all that information. I'm now going to do a round of single questions, so we're not going to do the whole round robin like we've done. It's a question just for you, and then I'll go just a question for you, et cetera, et cetera. So, Melvin Carter, I'll start with you. Earlier this year, there were interviews with the BCA and on Facebook where Dai Tao's former campaign manager said that your campaign is responsible for making these bribery allegations against Dai Tao public. Did you or your campaign have anything to do with making the text messages public that led to an investigation into council member Tao?
No, of course not. Our campaign has been focused early on investing in grassroots organizing, on connecting with people throughout the city. We've built a large organization that's really focused on hiring organizers and supporting them and building a large group of volunteers who are spending all of their time knocking on doors and connecting with voters all over the city. That's where we started. That's where we've continued. We've been so busy doing that. That's what gave us the success that we had at the DFL convention this past summer, and that's what's given us the momentum we have going into Election Day. That's been our focus the entire year.
Elizabeth Dickinson, I will come to you on that in a moment, on that question, Councilmember Tao. Elizabeth Dickinson, you do not have any executive or government experience. Why should voters trust you with a $560 million enterprise?
Well, you know, I'm on the National Board of Clean Water Action, and we have a multi-million dollar budget there that I help oversee. I would also say that basically no one here has been mayor before. So there is a certain amount of on-the-job training that actually has to happen. Nobody here has been in an executive capacity at that level. I would say that my background in terms of my emotional intelligence, which is a greater predictor than IQ in terms of making things work, is really important. And I would also say that I've done a lot of consulting with companies in terms of how they can be better managers by employing coaching techniques. And that's something that I would draw very, very heavily on in terms of administration. And I would also work with Kristen Beckman, who's the deputy mayor now, who I believe has a really good grasp of how the city runs, and she's been the behind-the-scenes essential component to what Chris Coleman has done, and I have the greatest respect for her. And I would work with her to make sure that she is part of the transition team and that she potentially stays on board as we go forward.
Tom Goldstein, during the DFL convention this summer, you were the first one forced out of the nomination contest. for lack of support at that event. You have won citywide election to the school board when you won your first term to the school board, but you then lost a reelection bid. Why should voters seriously consider picking you as their first choice?
Well, I lost a reelection bid by 400 votes in a race in which all three candidates were within 400 votes of one another. So I don't look at that as a rejection of me. I think, you know, it had to do with endorsements that were not given for reasons that had to do with internal school politics. I think why voters should trust me is that I have been someone who has not taken the safe course trying to be a politician, but is actually focused on solving problems with issues and calling out what I would describe as priorities in the city that have not served us well. And I think, you know, I talk about putting people before politics. That's not just a slogan. That's what I believe. And I also talk about electing a mayor who's going to fight for people again. You know, there's probably been $1 billion worth of promises by several of the other candidates, and we have about $100 million to address these needs. I mean, I'm somebody that wants to have a transparent city that's well-managed with customer service so that people, when they contact the city, they're taken care of. We need to be very transparent about what we're doing, and we need to have a plan. I mean, I've had a plan, what I call my blueprint for a better St. Paul, for the better part of a year. When Pat and Melvin both announced their candidacies and were asked about their platforms, they said, well, it's too early to really say. And Melvin had been having conversations for a year. So I don't understand how you can't have a plan when you enter the race. I did. It's a very thoughtful plan about how we do equity, about the need for broadband, about the need for job creation. I'm the only person here who has actually run a business and managed people. I know how to treat employees well, but I also need to set high expectations. And I think as a city, we have set the bar way too low. Stadiums and theaters and development subsidies are not a way to build a city. It's not going to address poverty. It's not going to address affordable housing. I'm somebody that actually wants to solve problems. And I've had some success that I don't tout because I'm not somebody who likes to talk about myself. But I organized a successful business. I brought the Gus Macker Tournament to St. Paul, which involved as many as 700 teams and 10,000 spectators and participants. That takes some organizational skills. I ran successful negotiating teams as a union representative. I worked on planning affordable housing days at the Capitol and pretty much ran a one-man operation opposing public funding, you know, including $1 billion for the Viking Stadium and $70 million for the Saints ballpark with cost overruns. So, I mean, to me, the reason is if you want a change in the status quo, these gentlemen that have served on the city council and, you know, everybody says how they were leaders on this and leaders on that, as if the city just somehow started going downhill the minute they left office. I think we need someone that's willing to challenge the sacred cows, that's not simply the way the city operates isn't a function of the Chamber of Commerce or police or fire or labor unions, but that it is actually, you know, everybody has good ideas, but nobody has a monopoly on ideas. We need to really listen to everybody and bring the best ideas. I would surround myself with really smart people, and that to me is how you innovate and move forward. And I think if you want to change the status quo, I'm the only person running that's definitely going to do that because I've been challenging the status quo for 20 years.
Pat Harris, how do you address remarks that you are Norm Coleman 2.0? Norm Coleman became St. Paul's mayor as a Democrat and left as a Republican and later served in the Senate as a Republican. Are you the Republican in this race?
You know, not a chance. You know, my progressive record is strong, is solid. You know, I have been a leader in affordable housing in this town. I've spent my life on issues in poverty. My proposals are addressing the issue of poverty and education, diversity, and so many other things, whether it's my board service, my time as a Vista volunteer, or what I do. I think sometimes I get that because I've been in the financial industry, you know, and I believe that's an important skill. 18 years of public finance experience. I know money. I know the city budget. I've always been a pragmatist about how to do things. But in those same breaths of trying to make sure that the city's affordable for seniors on fixed incomes and the city works for small business owners and the city works for new Americans trying to buy houses, and their property taxes are affordable. I've been able to find funding for the Catholic Charities St. Anthony Residence, or the PPL 4 Road Apartments, or the Gateway Project, the largest affordable housing development the city's seen in since 2000. And so I've always wondered why people say that, because there's no basis for saying that I've got some sort of conservative cred, and I'm the Republican in the race. When you look at my record, is really about my life record, not just my 12 years on the city council, but what I've done since the city council, what I've done before the city council. My life record is really about providing opportunity. I mean, my grandma and grandpa came to this country from Armenia, and they escaped a genocide to be here. And my whole life has been dictated around making sure everybody has opportunity when they come into this country, and when they're living in St. Paul or living in any community. And I've worked diligently on issues in poverty, on homelessness, on housing. But I want to keep the city affordable. You know, I think we need to look at things like property taxes and make sure that it is affordable to families in this town. And so I've never been certain as to where some of that stuff comes from, because I hear it. But I'm very proud of Laura and I and our family and the strides that we've made to provide opportunity in this community. And what I'm proposing as a candidate for mayor is really about opportunity, and it's about very, very specific ideas. It relies on a lot of my financial background to be able to identify dollars to put more money in the St. Paul Public School classroom, mm-hmm. which is hardly conservative, but I have a plan to do that. And so I'm very proud of my progressive record. I'm proud of being a pragmatist, and I'm proud of the impact that I've made for people in poverty, for seniors, for kids, and for everybody in between.
And Daitao, there were, as we alluded to a moment ago, bribery allegations leveled against you earlier this year. There were no criminal charges filed, though the text messages that came to light were less than flattering. What do you tell people that are suspect that that's how city government really works, and that that's how you would work as mayor?
Look, thank you for the question, Tom. For all I know, I'm the only candidate that's been clear any allegation in this race, and I have cooperated 100% with very thorough BCA investigation. And I encourage all candidates to participate and to cooperate 100% with any investigation that they are in, to clear their name so that we can trust them. And, you know, this is a very coordinated, sophisticated attack. It was done during the War 4 convention and War 6 convention. And it had President Stark, who support one of my opponent here, to go on air and to attack me, to try to strip away my freedom from my family. I have 5 kids. This is a very serious matter. And the trouble and the trauma that my family has gone through. But Tom, you know what I learned out of this whole experience is that I'm a fighter, and I've been through so much struggle in my life, from being in the refugee camp to growing up in the public housing. And I'd rather that they attack me instead of the people of St. Paul. I'm okay to take this burden. It just makes me grow. And I grew 5 inches taller. I'm much stronger spiritually, and I'm going to continue to fight for the regular people across this city. We're going to fight the status quo. We're going to dismantle the party, the politics as usual, that hurt us, that divide us. And the folks that, you know, came after me, you know, I forgive them, because I think we need a leader that can lead by example, that if you have something against your neighbor, work with them, forgive them, and let's thrive together. And that's our long-term, our vision for St. Paul. It's a St. Paul where we're united across race and culture and gender and generation, fighting for each other instead of fighting against each other. And this thing about transactional, right? Look, if you look at my record, I have proven record, and I'm comfortable with my record, that I've been fighting for everybody in this community. What's transactional are career politicians who show up in our community when it's election time, whose interest is only to advance their career. And you have seen my record. I'm someone who won't quit at halftime. I won't stop what I'm doing for something bright and shiny. I'll fight for you. And it's clear that the investigation has shown that everything the pay lobbyist that's colluded with other folks has been repudiated and found to be false. And so as mayor, you can count on me. You can call me anytime with anything that I can help you to make sure that you have a good quality of life. And my cell phone is 763-443-6243. I'm here to listen, to hear you out, and to serve you.
Will you change it to a 651 number if you become mayor? That was a joke. That's fine. Now we're going to go back to the format we had earlier. We only have about 15 minutes left, so time is a little bit of the essence, so just remember that when you're giving your answers. What specific actions would you take, knowing that the schools you would not have direct control over because there's a school board in St. Paul? What would you do as mayor to make public schools attractive to parents who would otherwise send their kids to private schools or move to a district perceived as better? Melvin Carter, I'm starting with you.
Education has to be a top priority for our city. It's how we secure the future by preparing our children for it. That's why when I was on the city council, I started the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood, which helps thousands of families in St. Paul put food on the table, pay the rent so the children can be stably housed, and has put family resource centers right in those buildings to help families connect with the resources they need. As mayor, I'll double down on those initiatives. I think there's a lot of other neighborhoods in our city who could benefit by that type of approach. I'd continue to support the after-school network that we have in Sprockets and the summer jobs and youth jobs programs that we have. I also think that we, as a community, the way we surround our schools and support them, our school district runs our curriculum and, you know, those types of decisions. But the challenge, the underlying challenge in our schools is that 72% of our children come to school from low-income families. So if children come to school wondering, worried about where they're going to sleep tonight or where, what they're going to eat tonight or if they can afford to go to the doctor, those are all moments that children aren't worried about doing homework. And so our focus to make sure that children come to school ready to learn says we can use our community centers and libraries as early childhood hubs so we can increase the likelihood that our children come to school ready to learn. We can connect with our community colleges and our local colleges and our unions and pre-apprenticeship programs to ensure that there's a wide range of roads available to success for the children who come out of our schools. And we need a mayor who can sell our schools, who can help to build the brand of our schools. I'm a product of our St. Paul Public Schools, J.J. Hill, Capitol Hill, and Central High School. I'm endorsed by a majority of our school board and our teachers union. And that's because of that work that I've done and because of the ability to look really proudly at our schools and to brag on our schools so that every family in St. Paul or families that are considering St. Paul know the high quality education their children can receive in our schools.
Do you send your kids to St. Paul Public Schools?
Absolutely. My children are at Capitol Hill right now.
Elizabeth Dickinson.
Well, I definitely support pre-K programs, 2 to 4-year-olds, as Rebecca Naker and I think Mary Vandevert have suggested, with the curriculum tied to the St. Paul school system to try and keep people in the schools. I definitely support full-service schools so that there are health resources and other things that people can come to school and get. I support the restorative circles because I know black kids are 3 times more likely to be sent out if there's a problem in the school, and the restorative justice programs have had a tremendous impact in keeping people in schools. At one school, there were 239 fewer referrals, meaning kids being sent out of the classroom in the first year it was instituted. I definitely support the Right Track program, which gives kids summer jobs, which leads them to having better achievement in school, better graduation rates. And there were 1,200 kids that applied for 500 slots last year. I think we need to expand that. And finally, I would reference my conversation with Katie Stearns, who talked with parents directly about what would keep them in school. And what they said is to have more schools with an arts focus. And so I think some of the places where we have lost students, especially in the Como Park, St. Anthony Park neighborhood, I think that we should really look at having an arts pipeline with an arts curriculum, and that's something that would be very, very attractive to keeping people in school.
Tom Goldstein, specific ideas?
Well, I think, first of all, it starts with the city needs to focus on stabilities for families, things that Melvin talked about, Elizabeth talked about. Kids need housing. Being a homeless child and trying to succeed in school is pretty difficult. Being hungry, not having access to resources, mental health resources. So I would say prior to the Promise neighborhood, we had Dayton's Bluff Elementary, for example, was also a venture there that was run by Wilder, where you had support services there, healthcare, counselors. That obviously is the model, having supportive services at all of our schools, particularly our elementary schools. I think the priorities that the school district, that the mayor can influence is using city resources to make sure that our rec centers and our schools are coordinated, that we are funding pre-K for those who cannot afford it. We have after-school programming, what I call a continuum of care, so kids are taken care of throughout the day and have some place to be and aren't simply sent out onto the city streets at 3 o'clock or 3:30 or whenever. But I've also, since the time I served on the school board, what I observed is that the school district and teachers and parents alone cannot deal with the myriad of issues that we face. And that's why I've talked about a citywide commitment that the mayor will champion. We need to tap the volunteer potential in our community. Opportunity St. Paul, which is a program that was just launched by Interfaith Council, formerly the St. Paul Council of Churches, to me is the best example I've seen of that. But we need to have partners with every school. They can't just be ad hoc partners where a business or a nonprofit is aligned with school. Every school needs partners. We have an example of the Hamlin to Hamlin Collaborative, where Hamlin University has students that go into Hamlin Elementary that serve as classroom aides, mentors, tutors. We need to replicate that throughout the district. All of our institutions of higher ed should have partnerships. Some do. But we need relationships with businesses and nonprofits and faith community, not just with adult mentors being in the building, but also the chance for kids to get out and see these potential career paths and find mentors and others who will guide them, that particularly kids that may be in homes where there is only one parent or no parents in the home. But I would also say, from a promotion standpoint, it doesn't serve the district or the city well when grievances or concerns are aired publicly and then the news organizations come in and talk about all the violence that's happening in our school. We need to be responsive when we have issues like at Ramsey to come in right away and bring adults in, which is ultimately what we did. That has caused more to lead kids to leave by airing our problems publicly rather than being responsive and dealing with them and continuing to have a positive message around the schools. I think that caused a great deal of harm, and those grievances should not be aired for political reasons. And so I would argue that as a mayor, what I said before, if our current mayor had spent the last decade talking about education and poverty and all the things we need, I think we would be much further along to addressing issues around the opportunity gap and promoting volunteerism than we are by touting one building project after another.
And did you send your child to St. Paul?
My son is a proud graduate of Central, Ramsey, and J.J. Hill Montessori, which is where I got involved on the PTO, became chair, and ultimately led to my running for school board.
Pat Harris, how do you make the schools more attractive to parents?
Well, you don't have to have your kids in the St. Paul Public Schools to know the value of our public school system. I can tell you that Laura and I, our four children, fifth grade down to kindergarten, I'll go to St. Paul Public Schools at Expo Elementary in St. Paul. It is imperative that we take specific action to make sure that our schools have the resources that they need to make a difference. Yeah, we are talking about larger issues like poverty and housing, and I do have specific plans on all of those on how we can make a difference. But we need to work with the schools to put more money in the classroom. I have several very specific proposals on the St. Paul Public Schools that will put more money in the classroom. I have over
18, from the city budget into the classroom.
From the city and a number of different proposals. I have over 18 years of public finance experience, and that's largely with cities and schools. So I have 18 years of working with school districts all over the country on helping them to manage their money well, manage their processes well, and to do things. And so I'm proposing a joint energy retrofit program between the city and the school district on a master energy lease that will put millions of dollars into the St. Paul Public School classroom. I'm proposing a very innovative program to put the St. Paul Public Library in targeted St. Paul Public Schools, where an actual St. Paul Public Library branch will be in a certain schools based on a community conversation that we will have. The library will be in the public school. It'll be a school branch, and St. Paul Public Librarians will work hand in hand with the school librarians to have resources directly provided to those schools. I'm also proposing that we take a look at how we use our cultural and neighborhood sales tax programs in St. Paul to fund the play area and Capitol Rec equipment around school districts, as well as replace lost music program funding in our St. Paul Public School District. So I have a multiple proposals on the St. Paul Public Schools that are going to put more money in the classroom. I have confidence in the new superintendent, Dr. Gothard. I think he's going to he's making some great steps. He's going to move forward on a lot of things in the school district. But the city has to be a partner. Absolutely, do we have to stand on the podium and say that we value and we support public schools and we need to be an incredible champion and cheerleader for our public school system. But we also have to be specific about giving them the resources that they need to have more money in the classroom and to be able to make the difference that they need to make going forward. Laura and I are proud to have our kids in St. Paul Public Schools, we're having a great experience there. And I just believe that they need the resources, the schools need the resources to be able to move forward. We also need to look at and continue to support great programs like Sprockets and Right Track and all the things that we do after school and making sure our libraries are open and available. I have to tell this quick story from Saturday, true story. I drove past Rondo Library the other day and two kids were waiting to get into Rondo. I drove around the block, I parked, and the library had opened and I went in about 12 years old. And I asked this kid, I said, if the library was open earlier, would you have come earlier? And he said, I'm always first to get in the library. I'll come when it opens. And we need to open the library earlier. We need to keep it open later. We need to do all these things, but we also have to be specific about putting more money into the classroom.
Daitao, and you send your kids to St. Paul Public Schools too.
Thank you. I think that, one of the things that we have to be conscious of is that we also have to hold folks who have been at the state accountable. And for the last 5 years, our grades has gone down, our enrollment has gone down. And those folks are the folks we depend on to fight for us and to make sure that we get our equitable resources that we need to educate our kids. As mayor, I want to promote safe school. I want to make sure that our young scholars have a safe place to learn and grow, and make sure that our teachers feel welcome and that they're given the environment and the space that they need and the opportunity for them to educate our kids. I want to also promote good character and respect. I think that's something that has been missing in some of our school, and so we need to continue to educate our kids and help them grow and learn in that sense. And instead of, some school, maybe we don't need SRO. Maybe we need two social workers to help with family and to help kids who might be in dire situation. As mayor, I want to work regularly and meet regularly with the St. Paul School Board, the superintendent, and business partner and stakeholders, St. Paul Foundation, the Wada Foundation. It takes a community to raise all of our kids. And so I'm that type of leader who works across all different sectors to bring us together to solve our common interests. As mayor, I'm really excited about visiting our school. And what I call is breakfast and lunch with the mayor. And what I would do is I would go into the school, and I don't wait till the school have a problem to do a press release. I would go and visit all the school. And then I would talk to the kids who are doing well. And I say, I want to thank them for choosing our school and to send a message to the parent that I say thank you. And then for the kids that are struggling, that are not doing well, I want to sit down with them and listen to them and hear them out. And I want to leave by saying, look, I care about you. I love you. You're like my kids. Our future depends on your future. And so if there's anything that we can do as a city, as a school, to help you grow and to learn, let us know and we'll do that. That's why as a candidate, when from the get-go, I supported all-day pre-K because I know how important it is for young people to learn. And then I'm also proposing moving our staff, using our staff time from Park and Rec to be in the school more so that the kids don't have to leave the school and then go to our Park Rec and Center. We already have these facilities, so sharing facility, bringing college students and elders from the community to teach, to try new learning technique, to learn about other people's culture, and to create racial harmony, and to cut and to cut the subsidy. We can't subsidize all these big corporations and big bank. We have to make sure that we can use that tax revenue to help our school and to help our community.
We are at the end of our time. I'm sorry to rush you there at the end there, Council Member Tao, but we are very pressed for time in about 15 to 20 seconds, and I do have to press you on time this time. As we end our hour, how will the city be better in 4 years if you're elected mayor? How do we measure you? Elizabeth Dickinson, very briefly.
I would say you would measure me by the level of community input, the fact that people felt heard and listened to, and that they actually saw some of their suggestions reflected in what the city does. I think that the city would see me in the neighborhoods. They would see me as a part of the community. They would feel that they could come up to me in the grocery store or at schools and say, this is what's on my heart and mind. Mm-hmm. This is where I think you're doing well. This is where I could see improvement happening. Yeah. So that people would feel that they were connected, and that we were convening and coming together to address any challenges that we had.
And I'm sorry, it has to be so brief, but Tom Holmstead.
I'd say that I'm the only candidate that's actually proposed accountability, and I talk about developing a citywide scorecard that measures how we're doing on several key indicators, including crime prevention, job creation, equity, sustainability initiative, and economic growth. Politicians don't want to be held accountable because then they actually have to deliver. I will deliver, and you'll be able to hold me accountable because we'll have a very transparent government that you can measure how we're doing from year to year.
Briefly, Pat Harris.
At the end of my time as mayor, I would want people to say that St. Paul was a town, a community where there was opportunity for all, there was housing for all, there was a living wage job for all, that we had viable libraries and green space, that our schools were strong, and that this city is a great place to live and work for everybody. And I have specific proposals to do all of that, and I'm looking forward to it.
Dietau, very briefly.
In 4 years, I'll say St. Paul, the shortest mayor in the history of St. Paul, got down dirty and got the work done, and that we're more united across race and culture. We're united across incomes and neighborhood, fighting for each other instead of against each other, and that we drew a line against the hate and the rhetoric and the disparity in our community, and that he needs to be elected another 4 more years.
Very briefly, Melvin Carter.
Thank you. I anticipate running City Hall just the same way we've run my campaign for mayor. And 4 years from now, we'll be able to say we've reimagined the interactions between community and police officers, that we've built a vision, an economic vision for our whole city in a way that expands the voice of people of color in all of our neighborhoods at City Hall, and that we'll have rejected the notion that our diversity is a problem to fix and realize that our diversity and multilingualism is one of our biggest opportunities ahead of us as a city.
There are topics we didn't get to, and I apologize for that, but you have been listening to a debate among the five candidates, these five candidates for St. Paul mayor, Melvin Carter, Elizabeth Dickinson, Tom Goldstein, Pat Harris, and Dietau. Thank you all for being here. Election Day is next Tuesday. Please vote. You can vote now. Head to mnvotes.org or nprnews.org. We've posted some links as well for more information.